Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from the University of Nebraska at Omaha on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Charles Johanningsmeyer, a professor in the UNO Department of English, and the Jeffress Chairman of English at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. The topic of his lecture will be Willa Cather, Germany and the Nazi Regime, A Complicated Relationship. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, November 21st, 2013, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the University of Nebraska at Omaha, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is James Shaw, Government Documents Librarian at the Chris Library, the University of Nebraska at Omaha.
Dr. Charles Johanningsmeyer is the Jeffress Chair and Professor of English here at UNO. Most of his research involves exploring how fiction texts interacted with readers and historical events. For instance, he is currently working on a book about how regionalist fictions published in periodicals in the late 19th and early 20th centuries affected their readers' views on gender, race, class, and geographical affiliation. It's not surprising, perhaps it's inevitable, that Dr. Johanningsmeyer's particular research interest would lead him to Willa Cather. He is, after all, in Nebraska. Tonight's presentation grew in large part from the year he spent as a Fulbright senior scholar at the University of Leipzig in Germany from 2006 to 2007. While there, he had a graduate assistant who helped him track down important German language materials unavailable here in the United States. Dr. Johanningsmeyer also visited a number of German libraries to examine copies of various Cather texts there. Through his wife, Gina, whose German language skills he says are much, much better than his, he was also able to learn much more about the Holocaust in Germany and how it affected the lives of that country's citizens. Dr. Johanningsmeyer was recently invited to give a presentation at the Center for American Studies in Rome on a body of Cather's English language fictions published by a German publisher between 1926 and 1942. He also serves as a member of the Board of Governors of the Willa Cather Foundation, a nonprofit group dedicated to furthering the reading and study of Nebraska's best-known author. Dr. Johanningsmeyer asked me to add that he would be happy to talk to anyone interested in becoming a member of the foundation, and I believe he already handed out some material for that. And before he steps to the podium, I personally would like to thank him for supplying me with much of this text. And it will probably be the only time in my life where I got to edit an English professor changing a few sentences from passive to active. Thank you. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Johanningsmeyer, whose presentation this evening is titled Willa Cather, Germany and the Nazi Regime, A Complicated Relationship.
Well, thank you, Jim, and I will say I supplied the information on demand. And I would like to second Jim's appreciation of your all coming out on this rather cold beginning of winter evening. I know it wasn't easy to get here, and I appreciate it. So, before I begin, actually, a few library staffers in the audience. I would also like to put in a plug, and I know a few people will join me here. I want to personally thank somebody who is the Interlibrary Loan Coordinator at the UNO Library, Mark Walters, who's not here, but yes, thank you, Mark. Without Interlibrary Loan, a lot of this research would not have been possible because he tracks down all kinds of fun things. When I need an Italian translation of Willa Cather's La Morte Viene Archivescovo from 1936, he manages to get it for me somewhere. So, anyway. Well, Willa Cather never personally set foot in Germany, and nor did she ever become proficient in the language. These two facts are quite surprising for a number of reasons. First, some of the most influential people in her life were German Americans. Second, She greatly admired a number of elements of German culture, its poetry, its fiction, and its music in particular, and she frequently infused them in her works in very positive ways. And third, she was a rather popular author among German readers from the 1920s on, due in large part to German publishers bringing out many of her fictions in both German and English. Cather's generally positive attitude towards German culture endured the anti-German hysteria in the United States during and after the First World War, but it became quite strained in the 1930s and 1940s as the Nazis rose to power in Germany, staged very public book burnings in 1933, and eventually went to war against Cather's beloved France and other allies, including, of course, the United States. Although we should be careful of overgeneralizing and saying that the evolution of Cather's attitude towards Germany, its culture, and its people represents the experience of all American authors during this time period, I nevertheless believe the evolution of Cather's relationship with Germany and its culture was relatively representative of how numerous American authors altered their thinking toward that country during these years. Both while growing up in Red Cloud, Nebraska, and later when she lived in Pittsburgh and New York, Cather knew a great number of German Americans, some of whom played important, positive roles in her life. Much has been made of Cather's acquaintance with Bohemians, Norwegians, and Swedes during her youth in Red Cloud, as well as the ways they appeared in her fictions. Many of you here, I'm guessing, might be familiar with her famous Bohemian character Antonia, and her Norwegian friend Lena from My Antonia, or the Swedish Bergsons and Carl Lindstrom from O Pioneers. Or maybe you've read her stories, The Bohemian Girl, Erik Hermansson's Soul, or Neighbor Rosicky. Often overlooked, however, is the fact that the largest ethnic group in Webster County during the time Cather lived there were the Germans, and that Cather knew a number of them. As a young girl, Cather's first taste of real intellectual life came from her regular visits to the home of Mr. and Mrs. Charles Wiener, or Wiener, a childless couple who lived directly behind the Cather's home in Red Cloud. James Woodruff, Cather's most authoritative biographer, describes them as, quote, educated European Jews, end quote, who spoke German, French, and English, making their extensive library readily available to Cather. They exposed her for the first time to what a cultured, cosmopolitan life looked and sounded like. The Wieners would later be very sympathetically portrayed as Mr. and Mrs. Rosen in Cather's 1932 story, Old Mrs. Harris. Mrs. Rosen plays an especially key role in the story by inspiring 15-year-old Vicki Templeton, daughter of a neighbor in the small prairie town of Skyline, and a girl with a striking resemblance to the young Willa Cather, to study hard at school, learn foreign languages, and attend university. Vicki, who frequently stops by the Rosen's house to borrow books, comments, quote, "No other house in Skyline was in the least like Mrs. Rosen's. It was the nearest thing to an art gallery and a museum that the Templetons had ever seen," end quote. Significantly, it is there that Vicki learns to appreciate the inadequacy of English translations. While turning over the Rosen's German language editions of Goethe's Faust and Wilhelm Meister, Vicki tells Mrs. Rosen, quote, "What I want is to pick up any of these books and just read them, like you and Mr. Rosen do," end quote. Similarly influential for Cather was her piano teacher in Red Cloud, Mr. Schindelmeister, great name, who might have failed in teaching her to play well, but did succeed in providing her with inspiration about what it meant to be an artist. As Woodruff notes, quote, "This alcoholic, derelict musician made a lasting impression, for he became Professor Wunsch in her novel, The Song of the Lark, which is 1915. The teacher, Wunsch is the teacher who gives the character Thea Kronborg, a young woman of Swedish descent who becomes a famous opera singer, her first music lessons. Wunsch pointedly encourages Thea to learn German, not only in order to expand her repertoire, but also to become a true artist who can sing with true emotion. To be an artist, Wunsch tells Thea, one must have something kind of mixing English and German, quote, in der Brust it is, und ohne dieses gibt es kein Kunst. And that translates as in the breast it is. And without this, there is no art, there is no art. And finally, one of Cather's best friends in Red Cloud was a woman her own age named Lydia Lambrecht. Cather stayed in touch with Lambrecht and her family her entire life. In fact, when My Antonia was translated into German in 1928, Cather sent a copy to Lambrecht and inscribed it, quote, for Mrs. Lambrecht, Lydia, and Pauline, the last of the Germans, from their old friend, Willa Cather. And during the Depression, too, I might mention, Cather frequently sent anonymous gifts of food and other things to the Lambrechts because she knew their farm wasn't doing well. So, as Cather made her way east out of Red Cloud, various people of German heritage continued to play influential roles in her life, and some of them were later very positively portrayed, quite thinly veiled, in her fictions. In Lincoln, where she attended the University of Nebraska, she befriended the Westermann family, which owned one of the local newspapers. As Woodruff asserts, they, quote, gave her the contact with a cultivated German family that she had had in Red Cloud with the Wieners, end quote. This family would later make its appearance in her 1922 novel, One of Ours, as the Ehrlich family, whose cultured example and command of the German language inspires Claude Wheeler to want to see the world and experience more in life. After Lincoln, Cather moved in 1896 to Pittsburgh, where she became close friends with George and Helen Seibel. And she even celebrated Christmas with them, occasions on which Seibel would recite poetry by Cather's beloved German poet Heinrich Heine. Once again, Cather had found a family that could provide her with what Woodruff calls an, quote, an enchanting cosmopolitan atmosphere, end quote. Not coincidentally, once again, that family was German. A number of years after Cather left Pittsburgh in 1906 for New York City, the Seibels would be depicted as the Engelharts in Cather's short story, Double Birthday. In this work, Albert Engelhart and his uncle, Dr. Engelhart, live in shabby, cultured gentility in Pittsburgh, while the hardworking, conventionally successful Judge Hammersley resents the way the Engelhart family had, in his view, squandered its fortune over the years. His daughter, the sympathetic character Mrs. Parmenter, greatly prefers the Engelharts' home and company to the much more sterile environment of upper-middle-class Anglo-Pittsburgh society. Cather thus endorses the cultured life as lived by Germans over the materialistic life of Americans. And finally, I would be remiss without acknowledging that possibly the most influential German-American in Cather's life was her publisher, Alfred Knopf. From the early 1920s on, he served not only as a publisher, but also as a good friend. Without his help raising her literary profile in the world, it is entirely possible that today the name Willa Cather would be barely known. In addition to the texts already mentioned, during the early years of Cather's career, from the 1890s through the 1920s, she frequently portrayed Germans and German culture quite positively in her fictions. A handful of scholars have shown how Cather incorporated into her works various elements of German culture. Most importantly, Wagnerian opera, but also Franz Schubert's Die Schöne Müllerin, Goethe's Faust and the Sorrows of Young Werther, Oswald Spengler's theories from Der Untergang des Abendlands, The Decline of the West, and German ethnographic practices of the early 20th century. There are numerous other German references yet to be fully explored, including the fact that Oswald Henshaw's business friends in her novel My Mortal Enemy, quote, seemed to be nearly all Germans, end quote, and that even years later he was found humming Schubert's Frühlingslaube to himself while washing his ties. The foremost investigator of such connections, Peter M. Sullivan, concisely summarizes, quote, Cather had an enduring interest in Germany and its civilization. Her allusions to German literature, history, legend, music, and politics show just how deep her knowledge was and how research of her topics brought a sympathetic understanding of the German heritage. Her references to this heritage offer convincing evidence that Cather embraced German civilization during her apprentice years.
end quote. Unlike a majority of Americans, too, Cather did not immediately turn against Germans during the First World War. In fact, before the United States' entry into the war, she came very close to making a trip to Germany in 1916 as a journalist. It was a plan to go behind the lines through Scandinavia, drop down into Germany, interview leaders. Didn't come off. I could tell you more if you are interested. Cather also kept her distance from the anti-German hysteria that swept the United States, where during the war it was against the law to speak German in public places, and acts of anti-German discrimination were widespread. Cather was particularly enraged about the Nebraska law enacted to ban foreign language instruction in public schools, a move directly related to general distrust of anything foreign. She also would have been well aware that at her alma mater, the University of Nebraska, a fairly large number of professors with German affiliations who advocated neutrality during the early stages of the war were put through loyalty trials, with some being summarily dismissed on the flimsiest of evidence. Even the beloved Schiller Linden tree on campus, planted in 1905 on the 100th anniversary of Friedrich Schiller's death to mark the value of German culture to a university education, was the object of some vandalism. And in a letter to her sister-in-law, Maida Cather, in December 1917, Willa's disappointment in her fellow Americans is quite evident. She wrote from New York, quote, "I asked a lot of people here to meet the charming German actress Hedwig Heicher last Friday afternoon, and several of them declined, said she was a German spy." She was querulous, and that's the end of that quote. But she added, with a touch of sadness, quote, "The worst thing about wars is that it looses so many unlovely feelings in people," end quote. Despite such anti-German sentiment in Nebraska and elsewhere, in the immediate aftermath of World War I, Cather wrote a novel called One of Ours, in which a Nebraska farmer named Claude Wheeler leaves the drudgery of the farm for military service, only to be killed in battle against the Germans, just as Cather's own cousin, G.P. Cather, had been. Although a few German soldiers are portrayed negatively, this novel also, as mentioned earlier, portrays a German-American family in Lincoln very positively. Furthermore, it roundly criticizes the unthinking people who persecute the German Yoder family, who live on the farm next to the Wheelers, as well as Mrs. Voigt, the proprietor of a train station eatery. Cather's own positive feelings about Germany were reciprocated by Germans when her fictions began to be published there in the late 1920s. Before Cather's death in 1947, 9 different English language editions of her novels and short story collections were produced and distributed throughout Germany and the rest of Europe by the Bernhard Tauchnitz firm of Leipzig, and 6 German language translations of her works were published by various firms. Many of these editions were reviewed favorably in various German periodicals, acquired by German libraries, and used for English instruction at both the secondary and post-secondary level. To fully understand the history of Cather's texts in Germany from the late 1920s on, though, it's essential to establish the specific cultural context in which they were produced and circulated. As some of you are doubtless aware, between 1924 and 1929, Germany experienced a brief respite from some of the social and political unrest that had marked the years immediately after World War I. This brief period in German history is known as die Goldenen Zwanziger, or the Golden Twenties, but they only got half of the 20s, I guess, for their golden years. The currency and government were generally more stable, and there was a major cultural resurgence that fostered experimentations in modernism, expressionism, cubism, and Bauhaus style. It's probably no coincidence, then, that it was during these years Cather's works were first published in Germany. The venerable Leipzig publishing firm of Tauchnitz published The Professor's House in 1926, plus My Mortal Enemy, A Lost Lady, and Death Comes for the Archbishop in 1927. And these were small paperbacks that were available throughout Europe, actually. The years 1928 and 1929 also saw the first German translations of Cather's works. Antonia in 1928, Einer von uns, One of Ours, in 1928, and Frau im Zwielicht, A Lost Lady, but in German it's a Woman in Twilight. It's an interesting difference. No, it's Twilight. Twilight at that time meant a woman of very shady character, let's just say. Now in Germany, if you buy it, it's Die Frau, das sich verlor, the lady who lost herself. If any German students here know that. After this, only one more German translation of a Cather novel would appear before the war, that of Death Comes for the Archbishop, which in German was called Der Tod kommt zum Erzbischof. In general, Cather's texts, both in English and in German, were quite highly regarded by German readers. In large part, this is because they were taken as relatively simple depictions of American pioneer life and of the West, both topics very much of interest to Germans both then and now. For instance, reviewer Friedrich Burns lauded the German translation of Antonia in 1928 for portraying, quote, the quiet heroism of pioneer life in the Western prairies, end quote. And I will mention that they, of course, all wrote in German, but I'm translating into English immediately here. The second Cather work translated into German appeared later in the same year, as did Antonia, and that was Einer von uns. What makes this publication unusual is that the novel was published almost simultaneously in cloth binding and as a slightly cheaper paperback. Somewhat surprisingly, given it was a novel written about an American soldier, Einer von uns appeared to have been quite popular. After all, a publisher would not have commissioned a paperback reprint of it unless it were experiencing high sales. Einer von uns also garnered generally positive reviews in the German press. Most reviewers praised Cather for her candid depiction of life in the American provinces and highly recommended the novel for those Germans who wished to better comprehend Americans. German commentators especially appreciated how Einer von uns helped them understand the American soldier of World War I, who had been portrayed by most German writers quite simplistically as the enemy. One reviewer partially explained the motivation of such a soldier, writing, quote, the story is about a young American excitedly going to war in the World War, and what is very instructive for the German readership is the depiction of the mood created by the capitalist propaganda in the United States, end quote. Another commentator expanded on this idea, pointing out that Claude Wheeler should be understood not as a naturally war-hungry American, but as one who rushed into war chiefly because he had felt disappointed in life at home. This writer reminded the reader that in this novel, quote, a young war volunteer at the front characterizes life in the Midwest as a sleeping sickness. Church and state, he says, have conspired against life, against the natural, healthy life of the senses, end quote. In these ways, critics thus presented Claude Wheeler as an American soldier who deserved the German reader's understanding and sympathy rather than condemnation. The next work of Cather's translated into German was her novel, A Lost Lady, published under the title, as I said before, Frau in Zwielicht in 1929. Translated by Magda Kahn, it won high praise from reviewers, and that review goes, if one could put all the books published during the last year in America on one scale and Willa Cather's Lady in Twilight on the other, the literary worth of this one book would make one scale drop like a weight, just as a bar of gold weighs more than 1,000 goose feathers. And God, I think that's the kind of praise that every writer hopes to get someday, right? In 1929, though, came the crash of the United States stock market, which concomitantly affected economies throughout the world, including Germany's. In large part as a result of the economic distress, the flourishing culture of the Weimar Republic began to disintegrate, and the Nazis rose to power, taking full control of the government in early 1933. All of this would have a direct impact on the publication of Cather's works in Germany. From the beginning, a major part of the agenda of Hitler's nationalist German Socialist Workers' Party was to control the production and dissemination of print products, such as books and periodicals, especially those containing literary works. In early 1933, the Reich issued a decree allowing for the, quote, seizure by the police of any books that, quote, tended to endanger public security and order, unquote, which led to a great many libraries and bookshops being raided. During the years that followed, the Reich tightened its grasp over literary production and distribution, making it impossible for any author to have a work published in Germany without the approval of one of the various Nazi offices responsible for overseeing print production. In September 1933, Minister of Propaganda Joseph Goebbels took control of, quote, the activities of all persons involved in literary endeavor, writers, publishers, booksellers, librarians, unquote. And not long afterwards, Alfred Rosenberg, director of the Office for the Supervision of the Entire Cultural and Ideological Education and Training of the Party, was put in charge of book censorship. One of this office's many responsibilities was maintaining and enforcing the constantly updated Schwarze Bücherlist, the book blacklist. What finally caught the world's and undoubtedly Willa Cather's attention were the mass book burnings in 34 German university towns on the 10th of May, 1933. This action against the un-German spirit, as it was called, was, as a noted historian puts it, a coordinated effort of, quote, one Nazi student organization, Deutsche Studentenschaft, to upstage another, the Nationalsozialistische Deutsche Studentenbund. It also served as great symbolic theater for the Nazi regime to rally the German public behind its campaign to purge the culture of any, quote, impurities, end quote. Cather would have been well aware of these book burnings, not only because they were widely reported in American newspapers and magazines Cather had access to, but also because on the same day, over 100,000 people marched in New York City to protest them. This march passed very close to Cather's residence in Lower Manhattan. Estimates are there were 300,000 people in attendance. Nonetheless, Cather, being the non-political person she was, significantly offered no public statement condemning the book burnings, nor, to our knowledge, did she offer any private opinion on the matter, at least then. Nowhere among the list of books known to have been burned by the Nazis in 1933, one should note, were works by Willa Cather. One can readily imagine, though, that Cather would have been shocked at this affront to culture. She would have been especially distressed to read that one of the targeted authors was her beloved Heinrich Heine, a popular 19th century German poet who happened to have been Jewish. Whether Cather knew it or not, it was Heine who in 1821 had written the prophetic and now well-known words, Dort, wo man Bücher verbrennt, verbrennt man am Ende auch Menschen. Which translates as, where they burn books, they will in the end also burn people. Quote. As the 1930s progressed in Germany and the United States was distracted with its own Great Depression, Nazi control of literary production became even more complete. Somehow, however, Cather's works continued to be published, probably because the Nazis did not deem them decadent or in any way ideologically threatening. Some of the ways an author could have been placed on the Nazis' blacklist, besides, of course, being Jewish, was by including in one's works various modernist elements, such as overt intellectualism, non-representationalism, tolerance of racial integration, or relaxed morals, or by endorsing suspect political ideologies, such as socialism or communism. Any art forms possessing such characteristics were deemed degenerate by the Nazis. Apparently, Cather's works were deemed free of such elements. Another red flag for the Nazis would have been the simple fact of a book being written in English. After approximately 1935, according to one historian, just having English books in one's private library made the Nazis suspicious, because that smacked of cosmopolitanism, and probably some sympathy for Anglo-American views. How and why the Tauchnitz firm continued to publish the works of Cather and other American and British authors is something still not entirely clear, and in fact, I'm still working on that for my talk in Rome in June. Cather's earlier Tauchnitz editions were often reprinted in the 1930s, and they were joined in the Nazi era by Cather's Shadows on the Rock, 1933, Obscure Destinies, 1933, My Antonia, 1936, and Lucy Gayheart, 1936. Significantly, though, I will point out, One of Ours was never chosen for publication by Tauchnitz, despite its having won Cather the Pulitzer Prize in 1923. I'm guessing that in all likelihood, this is because the firm believed it would draw too much attention from the Nazis for its generally anti-war sentiment. After all, Erich Maria Remarque's novel, All Quiet on the Western Front, was one of the first books to head to the fires. The continued support of a German publisher during this period helped spread Cather's name throughout the world. Yet one must also surmise that her work's continued publication by that same publisher after 1933 is another clear indication the Nazis did not regard them as in any way ideologically threatening. Given the suspicion of any foreign authors, it comes as somewhat of a surprise that one more German translation of a Cather novel was published amidst all the turmoil in Germany. It was Death Comes for the Archbishop. It was this translation that brought Cather, quite inadvertently, I will say, into association with a group of Germans actively involved in resisting the Nazis. In early 1935, Dr. George Schuster, an American scholar living in Germany, and more importantly, from 1929 to 1937, the managing editor of the prominent American Catholic periodical Commonweal, made arrangements with Karl Muth, the editor of Hochland, a Munich-based German Catholic periodical with a circulation of approximately 12,000, to publish a translated version of Death Comes for the Archbishop as a serial in the magazine, you know, a little bit of it each month. They contacted Alfred Knopf, Cather's publisher, who subsequently asked Cather for her permission. Cather's reply on 13 March 1935 indicates she was well aware of the Nazis' growing control over literary publication. And this is a transcription of a phone call Miss Cather made to the Knopf offices. Quote, considering present conditions in Germany, I should think a Catholic publisher was more likely to carry on than any other kind of publisher. The Catholic audience is well organized and knit together, and there doesn't seem to be such organization of any other kind in Germany except the Nazi kind. Several years ago, I said I didn't want a Catholic house to publish the Archbishop in Germany. The times have changed and Germany has changed. The Catholic audience seems to me the only one there worth reaching, end quote. Unknown to Cather, and presumably Knopf, however, Hochland was not just any Catholic periodical. According to Derek Hastings, quote, it was by common acclaim the leading Catholic cultural forum in the German-speaking world, end quote. Moreover, Hochland was known to be strongly resistant to the Nazi regime. In general, Hochland functioned as a liberal counterbalance to the more conservative periodical Der Graal, Katholische Monatsschrift für Dichtung und Leben, the Grail, a Catholic monthly for literature and life, which from its beginning in 1906 to its end in 1937 advised German Catholics to focus on their faith and not be as concerned with modern politics, a stance the Nazis would have endorsed. In sharp contrast, Muth's Hochland professed its allegiance to a more modern and liberal Catholicism. Not only did Hochland advocate Catholic engagement with Germans of other faiths, but also with modern politics, something the Nazis would not have welcomed. Furthermore, the Hochlandkreis, or Hochland Circle, of contributors included a number of people known to be resistant to the regime. Furthermore, Hochland editor Muth was even a known associate of Hans and Sophie Scholl, members of the White Rose movement that sought to bring down Hitler. If you've ever done studies on the period, you know the Scholls. The effects of Der Tod kommt zum Erzbischof being published in Hochland, of course, must remain speculative, as no reactions to the serial itself are known to have been recorded. Yet one might hypothesize that since no texts published in Nazi Germany could openly express resistance to the ideologies or practices of the regime, and that readers of Hochland were thus practiced in reading very carefully for hints of resistant messages, that possibly some Hochland readers would have seen Der Tod kommt zum Erzbischof not only as a story about two priests' adherence to their faith in the face of extreme environmental pressures, but also an inspirational conduct narrative for German Catholics who wished to resist those who sought to make them succumb to a world they regarded as apostate. The successful serialization of Cather's novel in Hochland and its possibly indirect involvement with the German Catholic resistance was unknown at the time to both Willa Cather and Alfred Knopf. In fact, it was only after the war, in September 1945, that George Schuster wrote to Knopf, quote, "This translation actually appeared in the magazine. When, however, the publisher requested permission to issue the book, Dr. Goebbels' office replied in the negative. No reason was given," end quote. With this brief, unsubstantiated comment, Schuster thus greatly deepened the intrigue surrounding the novel. Adding to this sense of intrigue was a piece of paper Willa Cather had attached to a letter she sent to an editor friend just 6 months earlier in January 1945. This list is headed, quote, "European editions of Death Comes for the Archbishop." Sounds simple. And it states, quote, "Der Tod kommt zum Erzbischof, burned in Germany. Publisher, Scientia AG, Zurich, Switzerland. German translation was burned in the street by Nazi police and plates destroyed, printing plates. Meanwhile, the translator had escaped into Switzerland, carrying with him carbon sheets of his translation under the lining of two suitcases. 2 years later, this translation into German was published in Zurich and had a very large scale." That's all just on that piece of paper. Who provided that list to Cather, and where its author obtained the information contained in it, is unknown, although it quite likely came from someone at the Knopf firm. When bibliographer and Cather scholar Joan Crane many years later recounted this information in her bibliography of Cather's work, she slightly altered it, probably unintentionally, in ways that made the story even more dramatic. According to Crane, it was no longer the translation that was, quote, "burned by the Nazis," end quote, but rather, quote, "this edition," end quote. That implies that it was an edition in book form of Der Tod kommt zum Erzbischof, that Crane lists as having been printed by the Victoria Verlag in Stuttgart in 1940. Crane then provides a bibliographical citation of the edition supposedly produced from Radecki's smuggled translation published by Scientia AG Publishers in Zurich in 1940, the one she labels E50. Appealing as it might be to Cather scholars who wish to highlight the subversiveness of Cather's texts, upon closer investigation, and a lot of close investigation, and that's what the article is about, this story of copies of a book edition of Der Tod kommt zum Erzbischof having been burned by the Nazis and a translation subsequently smuggled into Switzerland, it simply doesn't stand up. Nevertheless, one part of this whole dramatic story still might be true. It's entirely possible that some office of the Nazi regime denied the application to publish Der Tod kommt zum Erzbischof around 1938. This should not, however, be misconstrued as being due to the subversiveness of Cather's text per se. Instead, what most likely would have accounted for such a decision was simply the fact that it had been published in Hochland, which, as noted earlier, was a periodical deeply suspect in the eyes of the Nazis. It's possible that editor Muth purposely used Cather's novel to encourage resistance among Hochland's readers or to thumb his nose at the Nazi authorities. But Cather herself would not have wanted her novel about two obscure French priests in New Mexico in the 19th century to find itself in the midst of a very serious contemporary political conflict in Nazi Germany. After all, as she wrote to one editor in January 1945, quote, "I very much dislike being the subject of controversy," end quote. How then, one might ask, did a German language edition of Der Tod kommt zum Erzbischof come to be published by Scientia AG of Zurich in 1940, if the translation was not smuggled into Switzerland? Well, in fact, the arrangements for this publication were quite straightforward. An agreement between Scientia AG and Alfred A. Knopf Publishing dated 12 March 1940, granted, quote, the right to sell that book in the German language in an original edition at stated royalties, end quote. And in all likelihood, the translator Sigismund von Radeke just mailed his translation from Germany to Scientia AG through the regular postal service. Further details about this text's history, and this one actually has also an interesting story. It can also be found in that article. Meanwhile, back in the United States, I try to keep you bouncing back from continent to continent. Back in the U.S., Cather responded to the Nazis' rise to power and subsequently to the Second World War, much as many other American writers did, with somewhat mixed feelings at first, turning into indignation. Certainly, Cather was well aware of what was going on in Germany as early as 1933, as shown by her advice in June of that year to a good friend, Dorothy Canfield Fisher, that her travels that summer should, quote, not include Germany now, I think, end quote. And Cather herself made her last trip to Europe in the summer of 1935. And she, on that trip, she confined herself to Italy and France, the latter chiefly to see her gravely ill lifelong friend, Isabel McClung. Once again, she conspicuously avoided visiting Germany. In Cather's correspondence of the 1930s, there are definite flashes of anger towards Hitler and a very clear conception of where, unchecked, his ideology would lead the world. She wrote to the American writer Sinclair Lewis in January 1938 that she believed one major fault of Americans was that, quote, we don't like to believe evil. It's more comfortable not to believe it. We think Stalin must have very good points, and we know Mussolini has made Italy so comfortable for tourists. I don't believe we'll waken up to the situation we've drifted into until the knife is at our throat, end quote. While Cather herself could remain rather naive about Mussolini's treatment of the Italian Jews in 1938, she did accurately observe the same year that Hitler's persecution of Jews came, quote, from personal hatred, end quote. Cather's concern for the treatment of Jews, I should point out, was quite personal. At this time, some of her very closest friends were Jewish, including the Menuhin family, among which was the accomplished violinist Yehudi Menuhin, and Jan Hamburg, husband of Isabel McClung. Nevertheless, Cather appears to have continued to at least be fond of certain aspects of German culture during the 1930s, especially its music. In her 1935 novel, Lucy Gayheart, for instance, the eponymous main character's father was, quote, born of Bavarian parents in the German colony at Belleville, Illinois, end quote, and he, quote, looked like an old daguerreotype of a minor German poet, end quote. He's portrayed as a genial watchmaker and town band leader. Lucy takes piano lessons from the German professor, Paul Auerbach, and lives in a room above the Schneff Bakery in Chicago. All of these German characters are seen as very kindly. Cather also has another main character, the prominent singer Clement Sebastian, sing not only works by Felix Mendelssohn, who, as a Jew, had his works destroyed and disgraced by the Nazis, but also by Schubert and Wagner, the latter a well-known favorite of the Nazi regime. And in early 1938, Cather sent Yehudi Menuhin a birthday present of a book of Franz Schubert's letters, and around this time she was still attending Wagner operas in New York, often in the company of Menuhin. However, once the Nazis took over Czechoslovakia and later invaded France, Cather became much more distressed and angry about German actions. Writing in March 1939, Cather wrote to a friend, quote, what's the use? Hitler entered Prague last night. President Masaryk, who was president of Czech Republic before, was an old friend of mine. He was a scholar and a lover of letters. In my childhood, I had many Czech friends. I love their way of life, end quote. And on June 10th, 1940, the day Italy declared war on France and Great Britain as German troops advanced on Paris, she told another friend, quote, I think none of the personal sorrows I have lived through have ever shaken my days and nights, as has the gloom which has been gathering for the last few months over almost everything that has made the world worth living in or living for. Throughout almost her entire life, Cather had admired Italian art, as well as German music and literature. Here, in the middle of 1940, it would have been extremely difficult for Cather to muster much admiration for either culture as the Axis powers threatened to overpower France and Great Britain. As the latter went to war with Germany and Italy, and the United States eventually entered the war, Cather demonstrated her support of the Allied war effort in a number of ways. For one, she became an avid supporter of Churchill, telling a friend, quote, "Isn't Churchill a great old boy? Isn't England a great old land?" End quote. And she actually read his speeches for comfort. She also befriended in New York the exiled Norwegian writer Sigrid Undset, who was definitely on the Schwarzer Bucher list, and her son had been killed in the Nazi invasion of Norway. Further, she did what she could for the American war effort, not only by purchasing war bonds, but also by allowing three of her novels to be published in armed services editions for those overseas, and writing numerous letters to those soldiers who had written fan letters to her. She actually got a lot of letters from soldiers. All of these efforts, however, could not overcome her deep dismay at what had become of the European world she loved so much. And curiously enough, I might mention, there's almost no record of what she made of the war in the Pacific Theater. I find that rather interesting. She told Sigrid Undset on Christmas Day, 1943, quote, "The new evils we all know, but in their nature they destroy our power to combat them. The cold pride of science is the most devilish thing that has ever come into this world. It is the absolute enemy of happiness. The human mind, not the spirit, has disinherited human nature," end quote. And in early 1944, she wrote to her friend Viola Roseborough, quote, "Why should the cities that were 1,000 years of making tumble down on our heads now, in our short lifetime? What is the sense of it? We saw one war, and there was sorrow aplenty. But why do we have to see our world destroyed?" End quote. During this time, Cather became increasingly negative about Germans and their culture. And for instance, in her last novel, Sapphira and the Slave Girl, published in 1940 and set in antebellum Virginia, she included a few characters referred to as Dutch, Pennsylvania Dutch, but of course that's a misnomer. They're German. As Peter Sullivan, the scholar, succinctly put it to me in a recent email, these characters are always, quote, "lurking in the background," end quote, and, quote, "are presented as sinister foreigners," end quote, as well as slaveholders. In August 1942, Cather sarcastically questioned how many, quote, "pure Nordics" of the present Germany had actually read Goethe. And in what it must have been a painful statement to make for Cather, she told Yehudi Menuhin in April of 1945 that although she still fondly remembered their wonderful times hearing Wagner's operas together and that, quote, "I still love the operas and the legends," end quote, now, quote, "so much of Wagner has been rather spoiled for us by being boisterously played for very unmusical purposes," end quote, a clear reference to its use at pro-Nazi rallies. After the war, Cather pointedly refused to let any of her works be translated and published in German, either for the use of German prisoners of war in the United States or for the pleasure of readers in Austria or Germany. By the end of the war, and until Cather's death in 1947, one can best summarize her feelings about Germany, German culture, and Germans themselves by saying that she felt disappointed and quite betrayed by them. As suggested by the letter I quoted just a little while ago, the one in which she feels, quote, "the cold pride of science," end quote, most responsible for the mass destruction of property, lives, and culture during the war, it was as if the promise of the Enlightenment had failed her. Cather had hoped for a future world where the romantic German ideals of Goethe, Schubert, Mendelssohn, and even Wagner could work in tandem with the Enlightenment concepts of scientific inquiry and technological progress. Instead, Cather believed, science had been commandeered to make ever more powerful weapons and crush both the human spirit and all it had accomplished during the previous millennium. How the German people, with a culture that had produced so many wonderful things she had long admired, could also perpetrate such horrific crimes against humanity must have greatly puzzled Cather. And she was, I would venture, not alone in feeling that way. Thank you. I'm guessing we have time for questions? Or?
I'm like graduate student. I wonder, was she ever suspected by the U.S. government of being a sympathizer with the Nazis on any account?
No. Okay. I don't think she ever could have been seen in that way. But once the Second World War started, she was firmly a pro-go American forces. She sent, in one letter, I remember, she sent to a friend a clipping of a Red Cloud pilot who had downed a number of Japanese planes. She was pretty positive about that. So. Okay.
I've got about 8 questions.
Uh-oh. There are people behind you all. We'll take turns. Okay.
On the Tauschnitz editions in English, were they used for teaching English in Germany?
Yes, in
fact. So they're textbooks?
Well, they weren't. That wasn't their most of the primary intention. Think of these as the penguins of the continent. They were English language cheap paperbacks that tourists, for instance, tourists who spoke English who were on the continent and say, hey, I need something to read on the boat. I need something to read on the train from Rome to Geneva or whatever. You could buy them at book stalls. But also, it's rather interesting, on the inside of many of these, and you might have looked, I have some others, you will often see a stamp, and it's from a English Handelsschule, you know, a trade school and so forth. They were used for that. Actually, in something I'm going to write about, there was one wonderful Tauchnitz edition that just took a tiny piece of her novel, The Professor's House. It's about a cowboy out west, a guy named Tom Outland, and it's Tom Outland mit Wörterbuch with a dictionary, right? And it goes line by line. If you remember your language textbooks, you know how the teacher always says, okay, do these lines and whatever. It was for English language instruction. I also know that just a number of the regular copies were seen as very good for teaching English because her English was seen as so transparent, according to that. And I had the opportunity one time to talk about Willa Cather to a gymnasium in Germany, and they loved Cather. And they said, oh, this is so einfach, you know, it's so easy, you know, compared to trying to read, I don't know, some other writers of the period, Dos Passos, for instance. So.
Well, I was just wondering, you said that her take on the Italian fascism was not as strong as her German attack on the German fascism. How would, and obviously her work would have been published in Italian?
Yes.
How was she received during, like, by the Italian fascists?
I have no idea.
Really?
No, that's a little outside the purview. The reason I said she wasn't as strong against the Italian fascists was because in a 1938 letter, she talked about how, Mussolini, essentially, I can buy his argument. She says, I think he's mainly targeting Jews in this country because of the unemployment issue and this type of thing. She said, a lot of Jewish tourists, foreign tourists, are being treated very well. Mm-hmm. But boy, that Hitler, he's horrible. I don't know how she felt later. I don't see any commentary
when
on
would
that.
She have wrote that letter?
That was 1938.
Okay.
And she was very concerned in that letter. Her very dear friend, Isabel McClung Hamburg, was in Italy, in Sorrento, recovering, recuperating, and her husband, Jan Hamburg, who was Jewish, was there, and she was very concerned how he would be treated, but the sense was is that they weren't bothering foreign Jews.
Okay. Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to a lecture program from the University of Nebraska at Omaha on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Charles Johanningsmeyer, a professor in the UNO Department of English, and the Jeffress Chairman of English at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. The topic of his lecture was Willa Cather, Germany and the Nazi Regime, A Complicated Relationship. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, November 21st, 2013, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Charlie Reed, UNO Media Relations Coordinator, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 300 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.